During the time of the Buddha, four kings of guardian gods came to the Buddha. Now it is said in our books that there are guardian gods, and there are four groups of guardian gods, each group protecting each direction. And there are kings of those gods and then the gods themselves. So one night, at midnight, these four kings of the guardian gods came to the Buddha. And then one of them, after paying homage to the Buddha, so one of them said to the Buddha, "Bhante, there are deities and spirits, good spirits and bad spirits, who have no faith in your teaching. And also there are some deities and spirits who have faith in your teachings. But the number of those who have no faith in the teachings, or who are not well disposed towards the teachings of the Buddha, is greater. And your disciples, some of your disciples live in remote places, in the forests and so on. And so, for their protection, please accept this way of protection. For those deities and spirits not to harass monks, but to protect them, please accept this chanting of protection. When the Buddha said yes, accepted his offer, then that king of the gods uttered the protective chanting for monks to be protected against these unfriendly spirits and deities. This protective chanting presented by the King of God came to be known as Atanatiya Sutta. And it is recorded in the collection of long discourses. Now, the eighth Sarita in our collection is also called Atanatiya Sutta. But the original Atanatiya Sutta is a long sutta, since it is included in the long discourses. But the Atanatiya Sutta we find in this collection of Sarita is a short one. The original Atanatiya Sutta is about the size of 500 verses. But the Atanatiya Sutta in the Pareto collection has only 30 verses. So it is a very short sutta. But it is still called Atanatiya Sutta because those who composed the Pareto in this collection took 6 verses from the original sutta. and then edit other verses written by themselves. And it is done this way because the teachers in the olden days believed that the original sutta was too powerful. It could be recited only when someone is possessed by an evil spirit and people want to exercise the evil spirit. So for everyday chanting, the original sutta was too long, and also it is too powerful. So for to be suitable for everyday chanting, the teachers took only 6 verses from the original and then add some of verses of their own and composed this Atharvatthiya Sutta, which is the 8th in our collection. The 6 verses taken from the original sutta are the verses with which people pay homage to the 7 Buddhas. Now, in the teachings, it is said that there were many, many Buddhas in the past. But in the Atharvatthiya Sutta, only 7 Buddhas are mentioned, and only 7 Buddhas are paid homage to. Now, once Buddha visited the abode of pure beings, a Brahma world, so when he went there, he met the Brahmas there who were the disciples of these 7 Buddhas. And they talked about the lives of these 7 Buddhas to the Buddha. So after he came back to the human world, Buddha related his visit and also related the past lives of those 7 Buddhas, including himself. So from that time, it became a custom or a tradition to pay homage to the 7 Buddhas. So in the Atharvatthiya Sutta also, these 7 Buddhas are paid homage to. When paying homage to the Buddha in these verses, the Buddhas are mentioned with an adjective or tool, meaning possessing the eye of wisdom, or possessing boundless compassion, or compassion towards all beings, or having washed away all defilements, and so on. So these 7 Buddhas are paid homage in these 6 verses. And then there are 2 verses paying homage to the arahants. So these arahants are described as those who are disciples of the Buddhas and those who have extinguished all mental defilements and so on, and also those who are great and free from fear. And then there are the verses follow which pay homage to the Buddhas again. So in one verse it is said that those 7 Buddhas and the other hundreds of billions of Buddhas all these brothers are equal only to those who are unequal. All these brothers have great power. And the brothers in this verse are described as those who are equal to equal only to those who are unequal. Now that is a play of words. Now when people write especially verses, they try to repeat some sounds, maybe with preferably with different meanings. So here the word equal is repeated, that one is equal and the other is unequal. Now Buddhas have no equal. So Buddhas are the best of beings, and so they are unequal beings. Buddhas are equal to other Buddhas. So that is why they are said to be equal to only those who are unequal. So Buddhas are equal to Buddhas, but they are not equal to any other being. So they are described as those who are equal to those who are unequal. And these Buddhas are described as those who are endowed with 10 kinds of power, of courage. And also it is stated that all these Buddhas admit that they possess the lofty state of eminence. That means they possess omniscience. Now, all Buddhists believe that Buddhas admit that they are omniscient. But there are some people nowadays who think that Buddha did not admit to be omniscient. But in the books we find a case or two of where Buddha admitted to be omniscient. The Pali word for omniscient is sabbanyu. But Buddha did not say he was sabbanyu, but he said he was sabbavidu. So sabbanyu and sabbavidu are the same, they are synonyms. So you can safely tell that the Buddha admitted himself to be omniscient. Now, why did Buddha use sabbavidu instead of sabbanyu? Now, when prose texts are put into verse, some changes have to be made in the wording to suit the meter. So when you write a poem, you have to put in some more words, or you have to be to make shorter to suit the meter of the verse. So in Pali also, when something is put in verse, then there some changes have to be made to the word. So when Buddha admitted that he was he was omniscient, he used a verse. So in that verse, the Siddha meter, four syllables are needed, not three. So that is why he did not use the word sabbanyu, which is three syllables. But instead he used the word sabbavidu, a word of four syllables to suit the meter of the verse. It was through an ascetic that Buddha admitted that he was omniscient. Now, 2 months after his enlightenment, Buddha set out for a deer park to give his first sermon. And it is said that he went on foot. So he left the Bodhi tree and walked to Banaras, many miles away. So on his way, he met one ascetic. And that ascetic asked the Buddha, who is your teacher? Whose teaching you like? And so on. So Buddha answered, I overpower all beings, I know all, I do not have any teacher, and so on. And now I'm going to give my first sermon, and so on. So when Buddha admitted his omniscience to him, Buddha used a verse, and that verse requires the adequate social service, and so Buddha used the word Sabbavidu. So later on, that ascetic met the Buddha again. And at that time, Buddha talked to him and he became enlightened. In the next verse, Buddhas are described as those who are fearless among the congregation. That means Buddhas are always brave and they did not fear, they do not have fear of being unable to explain satisfactorily or being unable to defeat somebody in debate, unable to teach effectively. So Buddhas are always always ready with their answer, with their instruction, and so they are always fearless among the congregation, whether the congregation composed of monks or lay people or both monks and lay people. And then it is said that the Buddhas are those who roar the lion's roar, that means also who utter something like a lion. It also means that the Buddhas are fearless. And then the Buddhas are said to set in motion the wheel of Dharma, which cannot be turned back. Now all Buddhas give their first sermon, and that first sermon is called the wheel of Dharma. And the preaching of wheel of Dharma is said to be rolling the wheel of Dharma. So when the Buddha rolled this wheel of Dharma, there is no one who is able to stop the wheel or to turn the wheel backwards. So the setting in motion the wheel of Dharma is praised to be the one quality of all Buddhas. The turning of the wheel of Dharma is an important event in the life of all Buddhas, because with the turning of the wheel of Dharma, Buddhas proclaim a new teaching in the world, and they be taught the middle way, and they taught the four noble truths, including the noble eightfold path, which is the fourth noble truth. And it is the realization of these four noble truths that that make beings enlightened. So the four noble truths are important first to understand and then to realize. So the realization of four noble truths makes one become enlightened. And these four noble truths are described or preached or taught in this first sermon called the Wheel of Dharma. That is why the turning of the Wheel of Dharma is has become an important event in the life of the Buddha. And in the next verse, we said that Buddhas are endowed with 18 special qualities that are peculiar to the Buddha, and they possess 32 major marks and 18 minor marks of the great man. Now, I cannot go into detail all these qualities and marks. So the 32 marks are taught in one discourse among the in the collection of long discourses, and the 80 minor marks are mentioned in one later treatise, and the 18 special qualities are also mentioned in the in the Digas. In the next verse, the Buddhas are described as shining with surrounding halos. I think these halos are common to all religious leaders. And the picture of Christ is also depicted with a halo, and maybe other saints as well. So when they depict Buddha in painting, they put halos around the Buddha's head. But according to the book, it is not just around the Buddha's head, because the Buddha's halo shines around his whole body. Some Buddha has a halo as long as one span of his arm, and there are other Buddhas whose halo go as far as the end of the universe. And Buddhas are described as again omniscient, and Buddhas are those whose mental defilements are extinguished, and also Buddhas are all conquerors. That means they conquer all mental defilements, and they conquer Mara, the evil one. And the Buddhas are described as possessing great wisdom, great strength, a great power, great compassion, and unshakable concentration. So I think that is the most desirable quality, unshakable concentration. We do not have unshakable concentration. So Buddha possesses great compassion. Great compassion means boundless compassion. Compassion for both loved ones and unloved ones, compassion for all beings, not only for those who are his followers, but for all beings. And that compassion is called great compassion in Pali, and that great compassion is peculiar to Buddhas only. And it is said that Buddha possesses unshakable concentration. So Buddha had very firm concentration, and through this concentration he gained the enlightenment, or he was able to get rid of all mental defilements and gain omniscience. And it is mentioned that Buddhas work for the happiness of all beings. So Buddhas did not discriminate between those who are their disciples and those who are not. So Buddhas work for the happiness of all beings. And that is why Buddhas become for us the island, or the lodge, or the supporting ground, a protector, a shelter, haven, and also our comforters and our refuge. Whenever we are helpless, we can turn to the Buddha, or we can turn to his teachings, and then we can be comforted, and we get shelter in his teachings. And then in the next verse, the writer says, homage to the Buddha, saying, I bow my head at the feet of the supreme ones, or the unsurpassed man. That means I bow my head at the feet of these Buddhas. So this Sutta is like a recollection of the Buddha's qualities. Yesterday we met 9 qualities of the Buddha, but today there are more than 9. And reciting these, or chanting these the qualities of the Buddha, that gave us inspiration, joy, and happiness. And so, after stating these qualities of the Buddha, then we bow down, we bow our head at the feet of these supreme Buddhas. Now, the composer was not content with bowing down at the feet of the Buddha. That means he was not content with paying homage by bodily action. So he said, I pay homage to the Buddha by words and by thoughts. So he may say something or he may chant these verses, and so that is pay homage by words, and thinking of these qualities is pay homage by thoughts. And he said always, and he specified always by saying, while I am lying down or sitting or standing or walking. So he pay homage to the Buddha always. Then follow the verses expressing wishes. So the first verse said, may the Buddhas who are peacemakers protect you always and bring you happiness. Being protected by them, may you be free from all dangers. And the next wish, to be free from all disease, to be free from worry and anxiety, and to overcome hatred. And so the verses of making wishes follow one after another. And then the computer said, may the four great teams of God protect us by helping to be free from all disease and to be happy. And also he invoke protection from deities who live in the sky, or deities who live on earth, and also from Nagas. So he asked them to protect him, to protect us by helping us to be free from all disease and to be happy. And then he invokes protection from those deities who have faith in the teachings of the Buddha, or who are the protectors of the dispensation of the Buddha. So this Buddha is first the recollection of the uttering of the qualities of the Buddha and paying homage to the Buddhas, and then asking the deities to protect us. Now, this sutta ends with two verses, which nowadays monks use when blessing somebody, or when they want to express thanks to those who offer something to them. So the first verse is, may all calamities avoid you, may sorrow and disease be destroyed, may there be no danger to you, may you have happiness and a long life. And the last verse is actually taken from Dhammapada. And this verse states in fact that a person who is respectful or who pays homage to the elders gets four things increased, that is lifespan, beauty, happiness, and strength. Now this verse shows that if you want to have a long lifespan, if we want to look good, if we want to be happy, and if we want to be strong, both in our body and in wisdom, then we should pay homage to the elders. We should always respect the elders. So elders here means those who are older than we are in age as well as in virtues. So our parents, our teachers, and the Venerable Monks are those who are worthy of respect, and so who pay homage and who always respect and these elders will get these four things increased. So by chanting this sutta, we get a lot of kusala, we get joy and happiness, and we get to know many qualities of the Buddha. And also, we ask protection from the guardian deities. And so, we hope to be protected. Okay. Now, with regard to the practice, I want to explain to you the passage we read every morning. I have you read that passage because I want you to be familiar with the foundations, the four foundations of mindfulness, what these are. And the other thing is the guideline Buddha gave in these passages for the practice of foundations of mindfulness. The guideline may not be clear to you as you read the passage, because you need some more explanation, and so I will explain this passage to you now. I hope you remember the passage. No? He dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, removing covetousness and greed in the world. So here, the three words, right? The three words for these are the guidelines. Ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. So when we practice any one of the foundations of mindfulness, we must be ardent, we must be clearly comprehending, and we must be mindful. Now, although this passage is not in the form of giving instructions, because it just describes the monks practicing foundations of mindfulness. So although it is not in the form of instruction, we must understand that this is meant to be instruction. So when Buddha said, the monk dwells contemplating the body and the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, then we must understand that if we practice foundations of mindfulness, we must be ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. So we can understand it as instructional passage. Now, by the first word, ardent, that means making effort. Buddha tells us to make effort when we practice foundations of mindfulness. That is, when we practice mindfulness. So when we practice mindfulness, we must make effort. Without making an effort, we cannot be mindful. And here, effort means not a great physical effort, but mental effort. So we must make the mental effort to be mindful. So our mindfulness must be always supported by effort or energy. If we read the translation only and not understand Pali, and not read the Pali, and we lose something. Now, it's true that Buddha said we must make effort. But the Pali word used there is ātati. That has more meaning than the word ardent. Something in the back. Ātati comes from ātapa. Now, ātapa normally means heat. Heat of the sun or something like that. And effort is described as ātapa because effort burns or dissipates mental defilement. If you make mental effort, then mental defilement cannot arise in you. And even those that have arisen in you, you can make effort to remove them. So effort is something which burns mental defilement, which dissipates mental defilement. So that is why effort is important in the practice of meditation. Without effort, we cannot hope to burn the mental defilement. So when you just say ardent, we lose that meaning. So but if you read it in Pali, and you see the word ātati, you also understand that meaning. It is to burn up the mental defilement that we make effort to be mindful. So what kind of effort must we make to practice meditation? Now, I always say that's enough effort, neither too much nor too little. That is because I don't want you to overdo it. But the quality of effort we make must be a very firm effort, relentless and very strong. Now Buddha said, the effort you should make must be something like this. Let my sinews, bones, skin remain. Let my flesh and blood dry up. But I will not flinch. I will not give up this manly effort to achieve what I intend to achieve. So the effort you make must be very, very firm and persevering, although you should not make too much effort, or you should not overdo. But you need to have very firm and strong kind of effort to practice and to reach enlightenment. So we are not to give up effort at any time, and we must persevere in making effort so that we get what we want by practice of meditation. And Buddha always praised making that kind of effort, and he said, I made that effort, it is called silence. I made that effort, and I became the Buddha, and so I want you to make the same effort. So the effort we make must be balanced, but must be firm, and we must persevere in this effort. Now, by effort, we try to be mindful of the object. And if we do not make effort, we cannot be mindful. So when we make effort, our mind reaches the object, or our mind hits the object. The mind hitting the object or reaching the object is what we mean by mindfulness. So mindfulness is the full awareness of the object, and mind becomes fully aware of the object when it reaches the object, when it hits the object. So in order for the mind to hit the object, we need effort. And also we need one longer stage that takes the mind to the object. So one longer stage takes the mind to the object, and then when the mind hits the object, that is mindfulness. So we need effort and we need mindfulness to practice foundations of mindfulness meditation. Now when the mind hits the object, when there is mindfulness, then again the mind, as it were, goes into the object, not just being above the object, but it hits the object and it, as it were, goes into the object. And that the mind going into the object or sinking into the object is what we mean by concentration. So whether it hits just once or it hits many times, it must hit the object so that it goes into the object, and that is what we call concentration. Concentration comes only when there is mindfulness, and mindfulness can be there only when we make effort. So now we have three factors of meditation: effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So effort is one mental state. Mindfulness is another mental state, and concentration is yet another mental state. So concentration keeps the mind stuck to the object, keeps the mind and its concomitants unified and stuck to the object. So there are three mental states now. And when there is concentration, your mind becomes calm and still. So when concentration gets better, you begin to see the objects more and more clearly. Now you are concentrating on the, let's say, rising and falling. In the beginning, although you think you see clearly, you don't see very clearly. But later on, when your concentration gets better, you see more and more clearly the rising and the falling of the abdomen or any other object which you observe. So when first you see the object clearly, when you watch the mind, you see the mind clearly. When you watch the matter, you see the matter clearly. So first you see the object clearly with the help of concentration. And then you come to see that there are two things at every moment: noting and what is noted, or mindfulness and the object of mindfulness. Only these three things at every moment. There is a noting mind, and there is something that is noted. Something that is noted may be another mental state, or it may be matter. But the noting mind is always matter. So you see these two things going together, the noting mind and something that is noted. So when you see these two things going together, you come to know that there are only these two things, and there is nothing more than these two things, and nothing that we can call a person or an individual or I or whatever. So you come to see this clearly when you get enough concentration. And this seeing clearly is what is meant by clear comprehension. So when you reach the state of clear comprehension, you see the objects feel clearly, and you come to know that there are just these objects, I mean, just these two, and the noting mind and the thing noted, and there is nothing more. No individual, no I, no man, no woman, no other. So only these two mental and physical phenomena are rolling on and on and on. So clearly understanding is another mental state. So how many mental states are involved in the practice? Effort, mindfulness, concentration, and understanding. So these are the four factors that should be working harmoniously when we practice the meditation. But in the Sutta, Buddha said only ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. Only three Buddha mentioned. But we must understand that concentration is also included. Although Buddha did not say the word concentration here, we must understand that concentration is also meant. Because mindfulness is like a beginning, and clearly understanding is like an end. So when the beginning and the end are mentioned, then the middle is naturally mentioned. Because without the middle, there can be no end. So although Buddha mentioned only three components here, three mental states here, effort, understanding, and mindfulness, we must understand that concentration is also included. Or we must understand that by mindfulness, it means not mindfulness only, but mindfulness along with concentration. So at every moment, at least these four mental states must be working together so that your meditation is good. Now there is one more mental state which Buddha did not mention, and the commentators did not mention either. And that is faith or confidence. Faith or confidence is also an important factor, important ingredient of the practice. Because if you do not have faith in the Buddha and his teachings and in practice, if you do not have confidence in the practice, there can be no practice at all. So the faith or confidence is also an important factor, and it should be there when you practice meditation. But it is not working actively when you practice meditation. That is why it is not mentioned here. But maybe it is passively working, or maybe it is in the background of the practice, because without confidence, we cannot practice at all, or we cannot achieve anything. So if we add faith and confidence to these four components, we get five mental states that should be working at every moment of meditation. And these five mental states are technically called faculties. There are five faculties. That means five components here, five components of meditation. And the first one will not be working actively, but it must be there too. And the other four are working actively and harmoniously. So long as these five work harmoniously, our meditation is good. So by this sentence, or by these three words, Abhyanga's clearly comprehending and mindful, Buddha gave us a guideline for the practice of meditation. So, when we practice meditation, at least these four components of these four mental states must be working. We must make effort, and we must be mindful, we must have concentration, and we must see working actively when we take every moment of observation. So when these four components are working harmoniously, then we are practically in good concentration. So this guideline we have to keep in mind, whether we practice mindfulness on the body, or on feelings, or on consciousness, or on other dharma objects. Buddha said some more words in that sentence, removing covetousness and greed in the world. So, I'll explain it tomorrow.